John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends, with thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Did Richard Loeb and Nathan Leopold truly have intellectual superiority over everyone else? Or were they delusional narcissists who took their delusions to a new level? A level that included luring and murdering a young innocent boy in a Chicago neighborhood. Today, the dark story of Leopold and Loeb on the dark side of Wikipedia.
Sometimes the human mind goes to dark places. Sometimes those dark delusions turn into a reality. A reality so shaded and gray, once all is said and done, the healthy mind is drawn into the documented retelling of these tragic events, trying to find logic, reason, and understanding where there may be none at all. This is the dark side of Wikipedia.
Nathan Leopold Jr. and Richard Albert Loeb, usually referenced collectively as Leopold and Loeb, were two wealthy students at the University of Chicago who in May of 1924 kidnapped and murdered 14-year-old Bobby Franks in Chicago, Illinois, United States. They committed the murder, characterized at the time as the crime of the century, as a demonstration of their ostensible intellectual superiority, which they thought enabled them to carry out a perfect crime and absolve them of responsibility for their actions. After the two men were arrested, Loeb's family retained Clarence Darrow as lead counsel for their defense. Darrow's 12-hour summation at their sentencing hearing is noted for its influential criticism of capital punishment as retributive rather than transformative justice. Both young men were sentenced to life imprisonment plus 99 years. Loeb was murdered by a fellow prisoner in 1936. Leopold was released on parole in 1958. So I'll admit it, I did not know anything about this story until Carol had brought it up to me the other day and thought this could be interesting. Dark Side of Wikipedia, that's the program you are listening to. My name's Tony Bruschi. Carol Hughes with us today. Be sure to press subscribe at every platform it is you're listening to us on. So what drew you into this one?
Well, so as you know, I'm a big history buff.
Yeah.
And I particularly love Abe Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And so I go to any Abe Lincoln thing ever. I love Chicago. I go there every summer because I'm a big Chicago Cubs fan, as you know. So I go see the Cubs every summer. So one year I was like, you know, at the Chicago History Museum, they have this Abe Lincoln exhibit and it includes his deathbed, like literally the one that he died on. They brought it back, long story, but it ends up back in Chicago.
Yeah.
So that's what I wanted to see. And then I was thinking they might have some gangster stuff or some cool stuff. What they had was an entire exhibit on these, on these two guys at the Chicago History Museum.
Okay.
So it walks you through their life and the trial and everything. It was fascinating. I never knew anything about him until I stumbled upon this exhibit at the Chicago History Museum.
Interesting.
Because it's one of those, it wasn't a permanent exhibit.
Yeah.
It's long gone now. And maybe, who knows, they'll bring it back sometime. But it was really fascinating because I'd never had heard anything about it.
Sure.
And in its time, this was a huge story.
That's why I'm surprised I've never heard anything about it. Not that we were alive in 1920. But still, I mean, like, there's other big crimes from that era that you at least, you know, you've heard the names before. And yeah. This didn't even ring a bell to me when you brought it up. And for being actually somewhat close to where I grew up, too. No recollection or even thought of hearing this name before.
I think Clarence Darrow was the lawyer.
Yeah, yeah.
That was, you know, as I'm... Because I wasn't familiar with this at all. And so when I was looking at this exhibit at everything they had, like, they had a lot of artifacts from this time. Because, you know, they would have collected all the evidence that got stored someplace. Yeah. And they had it in this exhibit. But so we're going along and I'm like, what the hell? Like, Clarence Darrow was their lawyer?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just a very dark, yet... I mean, it's fascinating in retrospect, yeah. But it's super dark.
Dark and fascinating story.
And it's just two people who thought they were smarter than everybody and just kind of wanted to know what it would be like.
Well, now you can be afraid of smart people forever after hearing the story, because they may just be wondering what it will be like if you were to be barbecued.
And be afraid of the ones who just think they're smart.
Exactly. Yeah, that's the scary, scary ones. Let's continue into the story and see just how dark the story of Leopold and Loeb gets. The Franks murder has been the inspiration for several dramatic works, including Patrick Hamilton's 1929 play Rope and Alfred Hitchcock's 1948 film of the same name. Later works such as Compulsion, adapted from Meyer Levin's 1957 novel Swoon, and Murder by Numbers were also based on the crime. Nathan Leopold was born on November 19th, 1904 in Chicago. Son of Florence and Nathan Leopold, a wealthy German-Jewish immigrant family, a child prodigy, he claimed to have spoken his first words at the age of 4 months. At the time of the murder, Leopold had completed an undergraduate degree at the University of Chicago with Phi Beta Kappa honors and planned to begin studies at Harvard Law School after a trip to Europe. He had reportedly studied 15 languages, claimed to speak 5 fluently, and had achieved a measure of national recognition as an, I'm not going to say this one right, but I'll give it a shot, ornithologist. Leopold and several other ornithologists identified the Kirtland's warbler and made absolute observations about the parasitic nesting behavior of brown-headed cowbirds, which threatened the warblers. Richard Loeb was born on June 11th, 1905 in Chicago to a family of Anna Henrietta and Albert Henry Loeb, a wealthy lawyer and retired vice president of Sears Roebuck & Company. His father was Jewish and his mother was Catholic. Like Leopold, Loeb was exceptionally intelligent. With the encouragement of his governess, he skipped several grades in school and became the University of Michigan's youngest graduate at the age of 17. Loeb was especially fond of history and was doing graduate work in the subject at the time of his murder. Unlike Leopold, he was not overly interested in intellectual pursuits, preferring to socialize, play tennis, and read detective novels. The two young men grew up with their respective families in the affluent Kenwood neighborhood on Chicago's South Side. The Loebs owned a summer estate now called Castle Farms in Charlevoix, Michigan, in addition to the mansion in Kentwood, two blocks from the Leopold home. Though Leopold and Loeb knew each other while growing up, they began to see more of each other in mid-1920, and their relationship flourished at the University of Chicago, particularly after they discovered a mutual interest in crime. Leopold was particularly fascinated by Friedrich Nietzsche's concept of Superman, interpreting them as transcendent individuals possessing extraordinary and unusual capabilities whose superior intellects allowed them to rise above the laws and rules that bound the unimportant average populace. Leopold believed that he and especially Loeb were these individuals, and as such, by his interpretations of the doctrines, they were not bound by any of society's normal ethics or rules. In a letter to Loeb, Leopold wrote, "A Superman is on account of certain superior qualities inherent in him. Exempted from the ordinary laws which govern men, he is not liable for anything he may do." The pair began asserting their perceived immunity from normal restrictions with acts of petty theft and vandalism, breaking into a fraternity house at the University of Michigan. They stole pen knives, a camera, and a typewriter that they later used to type their ransom note. Emboldened, they progressed to a series of more serious crimes, including arson, but no one seemed to notice. Disappointed with the absence of media coverage of their crimes, they decided to plan and execute a sensational, perfect crime that would garner public attention and confirm their self-perceived status as supermen. Leopold, then 19 years old, and Loeb, 18, settled on the kidnapping and murder of an adolescent as their perfect crime. They spent 7 months planning everything from the method of abduction to disposal of the body to the precise nature of their crime and their motive. They decided to make a ransom demand and devised an entrance plan for collecting it, involving a long series of complex delivery instructions to be communicated one set at a time by phone. They typed the final set of instructions involving the actual money drop in the form of a ransom note using the typewriter stolen from the fraternity house. A chisel was selected as a murder weapon and purchased. After a lengthy search for a suitable victim, mostly on the grounds of Harvard School for Boys in the Kenwood area, where Loeb had been educated, they decided upon Robert Bobby Franks, a 14-year-old son of wealthy Chicago watch manufacturer Jacob Franks. Loeb knew Bobby Franks well. Bobby was his second cousin and across-the-street neighbor and had played tennis at the Loeb residence several times. The pair put their plan in motion the afternoon of May 21st, 1924, using an automobile that Leopold had rented under the name Morton D. Ballard. They offered Franks a ride as he walked home from school. The boy refused initially, since his destination was less than 2 blocks away, but Loeb persuaded him to enter the car to discuss a tennis racket that he had been using. The precise sequence of the events that followed remains in dispute, but a preponderance of opinion placed Loeb behind the wheel of the car while Loeb sat in the back seat with the chisel. Loeb struck Franks, sitting in front of him in the passenger seat, several times in the head with the chisel, then dragged him into the back seat where he was gagged and soon died. With the body of the on the floorboard out of view, Leopold and Loeb drove to their predetermined dumping spot near Wolf Lake in Hammond, Indiana, 25 miles south of Chicago. After nightfall, they removed and discarded Frank's clothes, then concealed the body in a culvert along the Pennsylvania Railroad tracks north of the lake. To obscure the body's identity, they poured hydraulic acid on his face and also his genitals to disguise the fact that he had been circumcised. By the time the two men returned to Chicago, word had already spread that Franks was missing. Leopold called Frank's mother, identifying himself as George Johnson, and told her that Franks had been kidnapped. Instructions for delivering the ransom would follow. After mailing the typed ransom note, burning their bloodstained clothing, and cleaning the bloodstains from the rented vehicle's upholstery the best they could, they spent the remainder of their evening playing cards. Once the Franks family received the ransom note the following morning, Leopold called a second time and dictated the first set of ransom payment instructions. The intricate plan stalled almost immediately when a nervous family member forgot the address of the store where he was supposed to receive the next set of directions, and it was abandoned entirely when word came that Frank's body had been found. Leopold and Loeb destroyed the typewriter and burned a car robe, or a lap blanket, that they had used to move the body. They then went about their lives as usual. Chicago police launched an intensive investigation. Rewards were offered for information while Loeb went about his daily routine quietly. Leopold spoke freely to police and reporters, offering theories as to anyone who would listen. He even told one detective, "If I were to murder anybody, it would be just such a cocky little son of a bitch as Bobby Franks." Police found a pair of eyeglasses near the body. Though common in prescription and frame, they were fitted with an unusual hinge purchased by only 3 customers in Chicago, one of whom was Leopold. When questioned, Leopold offered the possibility that his glasses might have dropped out of his pocket during a bird-watching trip the previous weekend. The destroyed typewriter was recovered from Jackson Park Lagoon on June 7th. The two men were summoned for formal questioning on May 29th. They asserted that on the night of the murder, they had picked up 2 women in Chicago using Leopold's car, then dropped them off sometime later near a golf course without learning their last names. Their alibi was exposed as a fabrication when Leopold's chauffeur told police that he was repairing Leopold's car that night while the men claimed to be using it. The chauffeur's wife later confirmed that the car was parked in the Leopold garage on the night of the murder. So, I'm not understanding here where in their logic their actions made them appear to be intelligent.
But see, I think there are two people who probably wouldn't have done this had they never met.
Yeah.
And I think they thought they were so smart that they could do this perfect crime.
Yeah.
And didn't think about, oh, my glasses fell out of my pocket. You know, it's like at the same time, like they think they are so smart and better than everybody else, but obviously not.
Yeah.
That they think they are. That's the way I kind of read it.
I think anybody that walks around and kind of thinks that way is probably not that smart.
Like, to be so bold, and you hear of it frequently. You know, arsonists, you know, the fire is going on and they show up to watch it.
Yeah.
But this guy's like, if I was to kill somebody, that's exactly the type of kid I'd kill.
Who says that?
Who does that? Like, that's how I think, like, I honest to God think they thought they were so smart and they had done it.
Yeah.
Because if you work on something for 9 months, that's kind of obsessive when you're planning a crime and you've worked on it and you really think that you've done everything. So, yeah, we are so smart. We can just be so bold and be like,
I wonder what the diagnosis
is. I feel that kid too, man.
I wonder what the diagnosis is on these two state of mind. I mean, all looking at it retrospectively, but wonder what they would say that they had or what how their brains work. Because obviously there's a disorder going on here.
I think that separately, because they were both incredibly smart people.
Yeah.
The one graduated college at like 17. The other spoke like 5 languages fluently, not to mention the others that he, you know, kind of spoke. You know, like really, really, really smart people.
But then when it comes to committing crimes, pretty sloppy.
Then when they got together, and I think there's more of a relationship between the two of them.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
But I think when they got together, they just kind of created that Superman thing.
Yeah.
Like this power thing they thought they had.
They fed off each other. I mean, it's almost kind of cult-like, but like on a really micro scale. Where the two of them just fed off of each other as like these ultimate leaders, and then they believed their own hype.
Yeah.
Very bizarre. Let's continue into the story of Leopold and Loeb as the case against them begins. Loeb confessed first. He asserted that Leopold had planned everything and had killed Franks in the backseat of the car while Loeb drove. Leopold's confession followed swiftly thereafter, but he insisted that he was the driver and Loeb was the murderer. Their confessions otherwise corroborated most of the evidence in the case. Leopold later claimed in his book, long after Loeb was dead, that he pleaded in vain with Loeb to admit to killing Franks. Momsy feels less terrible than she might, thinking you did it, he quotes Loeb as saying, and I'm not going to take that shred of comfort away from her. While most observers believe that Loeb did indeed strike the fatal blow, some circumstantial evidence, including testimony from eyewitness Carl Ulvich, who said he saw Loeb driving and Leopold in the back seat minutes before the kidnapping, suggested that Leopold could have been the killer. Both Leopold and Loeb admitted that they were driven by their thrill-seeking delusions and their aspiration to commit a perfect crime. Neither claimed to have looked forward to the killing itself, although Leopold admitted interest in learning what it would feel like to be a murderer. He was disappointed to note that he felt the same as ever. Defense attorney Clarence Darrow was part of the trial of Leopold and Loeb at Chicago's Cook County Courthouse. Now Courthouse Place became the media spectacle and the third after those of Harry Thaw and Sacco and Vanzetti. To be labeled the trial of the century. Loeb's family hired Clarence Darrow, one of the most renowned criminal defense lawyers in the country, to lead the defense team. It was rumored that Darrow was paid $1 million for his services, though he was actually paid $70,000, equivalent to $1 million in 2019. Darrow took the case because he was a staunch opponent of capital punishment. While it was generally assumed that the men's defense would be based on a plea and not guilty by reason of insanity, Darrow concluded that a jury trial would almost certainly end in conviction and the death penalty. Thus, he elected to enter a plea of guilty, hoping to convince Cook County Circuit Court Judge John R. Calvary to impose sentences of life imprisonment. The trial, technically a sentencing hearing because of the entry of guilty pleas, ran for 32 days. The state's attorney, Robert E. Crow, presented over 100 witnessing documents detailing the crime. The defense presented extensive psychiatric testimony in an effort to establish mitigating circumstances, including childhood neglect in the form of absent parenting and, in Leopold's case, sexual abuse by a governess. Darrow called a series of expert witnesses who offered a catalog of Leopold and Loeb's abnormalities. One witness testified to their dysfunctional endocrine glands, another to the delusions that had led to their crime. Darrow's impassioned 12-hour-long masterful plea at the conclusion of the hearing has been called the finest speech of his career. Its principal theme was the inhumane methods and punishments of the American justice system and the youth and immaturity of the accused. This terrible crime was inherent in its organism, and it came from the same ancestor. Is any blame attached because somebody took Nitschke's philosophy seriously and fashioned his life upon it? It is hardly fair to hang a 19-year-old boy for the philosophy that was taught him at the university. Now, Your Honor, I have spoken about the war. I believe in it. I don't know whether I was crazy or not. Sometimes I think perhaps I was. I approved of it. I joined in the general cry of madness and despair. I urged men to fight. I was safe because I was too old to go. I was like the rest. What did they do? Right or wrong, justifiable or unjustifiable, which I need not discuss today, it changed the world. Four long years, the civilized world was engaged in killing men, Christian against Christian, barbarian, uniting with Christians to kill Christians, anything to kill. It was taught in every school. And in the Sunday schools, the little children played at war, the toddling children on the street. Do you suppose this world has ever been the same since? How long, Your Honor, will it take for the world to get back the humane emotions that were slowly growing before the war? How long will it take the calloused hearts of men before the scars of hatred and cruelty shall be removed? We read of killing 100,000 men in a day. We read about it and we rejoice in it. If it was the other fellows who were killed, we were fed on the flesh and drank blood, even down to the prattling babe. I need not tell you how many upright, honorable young boys have come into this court charged with murder, some saved and some sent to their death. Boys who fought in this war and learned to place a cheap value on human life. You know it and I know it. These boys were brought up in it. The tales of death were in their homes, their playgrounds, their schools, and they were in the newspapers that they read. It was a part of the common frenzy. What was a life? It was nothing. It was the least sacred thing in existence, and these boys were trained to this cruelty. It will take 50 years to wipe it out of the human heart, if ever. I know this, that after the Civil War in 1865, crimes of this sort increased marvelously. No one needs to tell me that crime has no cause. It has as definite a cause as any other disease, and I know that out of the hatred and bitterness of the Civil War, crime increased as America had never seen before. I know that Europe is going through the same experience today. I know it has followed every war, and I know it has influenced these boys so that life was not the same to them as it would have been if the world had not made red with blood. I protest against the crimes and mistakes of society being visited upon them. All of us have share in it. I have mine. I cannot tell, and I shall never know how many words of mine might have given birth to cruelty in place of love and kindness and charity. Your Honor knows that in this very court, crimes of violence have increased going and growing out of the war, not necessarily by those who fought, but by those that learned that blood was cheap and human life was cheap. And if the state could take it lightly, why not a boy? There are causes for this terrible crime. There are causes, as Vaya said, for everything that happens in this world. War is a part of it. Education is a part of it. Birth is a part of it. Money is a part of it. All these conspired to compass the destruction of these two poor boys. Has the court any right to consider anything but these two boys? The state says that Your Honor has a right to consider the welfare of the community, as you have. If the welfare of the community would be benefited by taking these lives, well and good. I think it would work evil that no one could measure. Has Your Honor a right to consider the families of these defendants? I've been sorry. I am sorry for the bereavement of Mr. and Mrs. Franks, for those broken ties they cannot be healed. All I can hope and wish is that some good may come from all of it. But as compared with the families of Leopold and Loeb, the Franks are to be envied, and everyone knows it. I do not know how much salvage there is in these two boys. I hate to say it in their presence, but what is there to look forward to? I do not know, but what Your Honor would be merciful to them, but not merciful to civilization, and not merciful if you tied a rope around their necks and let them die. Merciful to them, but not merciful to civilization, and not merciful to those who would be left behind. To spend the balance of their days in prison is mighty little to look forward to. If anything, is it anything? They may have the hope that as these years roll around, they might be released. I do not know. I do not know. I will be honest with this court, as I have tried to be from the beginning. I know that these boys are not fit to be at large. I believe they will not be until they pass through the next stage of life at 45 or 50. Whether they will then, I cannot tell. I'm sure of this, that I will not be here to help them. So far as I am concerned, it is over. I will not tell this court that I do not hope that sometime when life and age have changed their bodies as they do and have changed their emotions as they do, that they may once more return to life. I would be the last person on earth to close the door of hope to any human being that lives, at least of all to my clients. But what have they to look forward to? Nothing. And I think here of the stanza of Hausmann. Now hollow fires burn out to black and lights are fluttering low. Square your shoulders, lift your pack and leave your friends and go. Oh, never fear, lads, naught's to dread. Look not left nor right. In all the endless road you tread, there's nothing but the night. I care not, Your Honor, whether the march begins at the gallows or when the gates of Joliet close upon them. There's nothing but the night. And that is little for any human being to expect, but there are others to consider. Here are these two families who have led honest lives, who will bear the name that they bear, and future generations must carry on. Here's Leopold's father, and this boy was the pride of his life. He watched him, he cared for him, he worked for him. The boy was brilliant and accomplished. He educated him, and he taught that fame and position awaited him, as it should have awaited. It's a hard thing for a father to see his life's hopes crumble into dust. Should he be considered? Should his brothers be considered? Will it do society any good or make your life safer or any human being's life safer if it should be handed down from generation to generation that this boy, their kin, died upon the scaffold? And Loeb's the same. Here is the faithful uncle and brother who have watched here day by day. Well, Dickie's father and his mother are too ill to stand this terrific strain. And she'll be waiting for a message which means more to them than it can mean to you or me. Shall these be taken into account in this general bereavement? Have they any rights? Is there any reason, Your Honor, why their proud names and all future generations that bear them shall have this bar sinister written across them? How many boys and girls, how many unborn children will feel it? It is bad enough as it is, God knows it's bad enough, however it is, but it's not yet death on the scaffold. It's not that. I ask Your Honor, in addition to all that I have said, to save two honorable families from a disgrace that never ends, which could be of no avail to any human being that lives. I must say a word more, and then I will leave you with where I should have left it long ago. None of us are unmindful of the public. Courts are not. Juries are not. We placed our fate in the hands of a trained court, thinking that he would be more mindful and considerate than a jury. I cannot say how people feel. I've stood here for 3 months, as one might stand at the ocean trying to sweep back the tide. I hope the seas are subsiding and the wind is falling, and I believe they are, but I wish to make no false pretense to this court. The easy thing and the popular thing to do is to hang my clients. I know it. Men and women who do not think will applaud. The cruel and thoughtless will approve. It'll be easy today, but in Chicago and reaching out over the length and breadth of the land, more and more fathers and mothers, the humane, the kind, and the hopeful who are gaining and understanding and asking questions, not only about these poor boys, but about their own, these will join in no acclaim at the death of my clients. These would ask that the shedding of blood be stopped and that the normal feelings of man resume their sway. And as the days and the months and the years go by, they will ask it more and more. But, Your Honor, what they shall ask may not count. I know the easy way. I know the future is with me. And what I stand for here, not merely for the lives of these two unfortunate lads, but for all boys and all girls, for all the young, and as far as possible for all of the old. I'm pleading for life, understanding, charity, kindness, and the infinite mercy that considers all. I'm pleading that we overcome cruelty with kindness and hatred with love. I know the future is on my side. Your Honor stands between the past and the future. You may hang these boys, you may hang them by the neck until they are dead. But in doing it, you'll turn your face towards the past. In doing it, you're making it harder for every other boy who in ignorance and darkness must grope his way through the mazes which only childhood knows. In doing it, you'll make it harder for unborn children. You may save them and make it easier for every child that sometime may stand where these boys stand. You'll make it easier for every human being with an aspiration and a vision and a hope and a fate. I'm pleading for the future. I'm pleading for a time when hatred and cruelty will not control the hearts of men. We can learn by reason and judgment and understanding and faith that all life is worth saving and that mercy is the highest attribute of man. I feel that I should apologize for the length of time I have taken. This case may not be as important as I think it is, and I'm sure I do not need to tell the court or to tell my friends that I would fight just as hard for the poor as for the rich. If I should succeed, my greatest reward for my greatest hope will be that for the countless unfortunates who must tread the same road in the blind childhood that these poor boys have trod, that I have done something to help human understanding, to temper justice with mercy, to overcome hate with love. I was reading last night of the aspiration of the old Persian poet Omar Khayyam. It appeared to me as the highest that I can vision. I wish it was in my heart, and I wish it was in the hearts of all. So I'll be written in the book of love. I do not care about that book above. Erase my name or write it as you will, so I will be written in the book of love. The judge was persuaded. According to his ruling, his decision was based on precedent, and the youth of the accused, after 12 days on September 10, 1924, he sentenced both Leopold and Loeb to life imprisonment for the murder and an additional 99 years for the kidnapping. A little over a month later, Loeb's father died of heart failure. Do I win an award for my
portrayal? I thought you did a really good job with that. Whew. You didn't have to read all 12 hours of it.
I know. I was wondering, well, how long is this going to go? I don't think I have that many pages here. But yeah, I don't think I've ever really done a dramatic reading like that before on any show.
I thought that was really good.
It's kind of fun. Kind of like
and
that.
To read Clarence Darrow's bullshit words.
Yeah.
Because, excuse me, but a lot of that was like, I don't remember how old they were when they did this, mm-hmm. but they were not boys.
Yeah.
And the way he kept referring to them as boys was just offensive to me. And at one point he said, boys and girls, like they're just little kindergartners.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then like, it was like, I feel sorry for his family, you know, the boy,
yeah.
literal boy, because he was 14 who was murdered. But, you know, it's like, it was just bullshit.
The one that's suffering the most is the people who are going to have their children killed who killed the other kid. No, I mean, I don't think that is necessarily... Yeah.
They're going to be in prison. Poor you, at least you got it over with.
And if we're going to point out all of these reasons why the individuals, why Leopold and Loeb turned out this way, and it all goes back to the parents and shitty parenting, then why do we care about their feelings at that point? It's kind of how I look at it. It's like, okay, so they were bad parents, and now we're going to argue of why we should spare their feelings when these lunatic children they raised thought it'd be a great idea to kidnap and murder a 14-year-old. Fuck you. It's just like, no. It's equating two totally different things in that speech. Love and care for fellow human beings and somehow trying to finagle murderers into having to have normal people, sane people, to have sympathy for cold-blooded killing. It just doesn't work. It doesn't make any sense. But quite a dramatic speech, I'll certainly say that.
Well, oh my God, could you imagine sitting in the courtroom that whole time? It's like, shut up.
How many spitballs
we
do you think landed
you
on him?
Shut up. Now you're just talking to hear yourself talk.
And this that is before court TV and everything, too. So, like, if you're in the room, you get it. If not, sorry.
I couldn't imagine that.
Could you imagine being the stenographer for that? Did they have? They must have had stenographers back then. That's probably how we got the speech.
Oh, God, I imagine so.
Oh, my God. 12 hours of straight typing Clarence Darrow. Holy shit.
And then in the transcript, shut up.
It's like just randomly, shut the fuck up.
And are you going to continue on? Is there a little bit more to this?
There is a little bit more to this. Okay. So let's continue into the rest of the story of Leopold and Loeb. Leopold and Loeb were initially held at Joliet Prison, although they were kept apart as much as possible. The two managed to maintain a friendship behind bars. Leopold was later transferred to Statesville Penitentiary, and Loeb was eventually transferred there as well. Once reunited, the two expanded the prison school system, adding a high school and junior college curriculum. Loeb's death in prison on January 28, 1936. Loeb was attacked by fellow inmate James Day with a straight razor in a shower room and died soon after in the prison hospital. Day claimed that Loeb had assaulted him, though he was unharmed, while Loeb sustained more than 50 wounds, including defensive wounds on his arms and hands. His throat had also been slashed from behind. News accounts suggested Loeb had propositioned Day, the authorities perhaps embarrassed by publicity sensationalizing alleged decadent behavior in the prison, ruled that Day had been defending himself. Well, some have claimed that newsman Ed Leahy wrote his clever lead for the Chicago Daily News. Richard Loeb, despite his erudition today, ended his sentence with a proposition. No evidence that this lead was ever published has been found. An actual copy from the date reads otherwise. Other newspapers at the time appeared to praise Day, who was later tried and acquitted of Loeb's murder. A sexual motive for the killing had been suggested. However, there's no evidence that Loeb was a sexual predator while in prison, but Day was later caught at least once in a sexual act with a fellow inmate. In his autobiography, Life Plus 99 Years, Leopold ridiculed Day's claim that Loeb had attempted to sexually assault him. This was echoed by the prison's Catholic chaplain, a confidant of Loeb's, who said that it was more likely that Day had attacked Loeb after Loeb rebuffed his advances. Although Leopold continued his work in prison after Loeb's death, he suffered from depression. He became a model prisoner and made many significant contributions to improving conditions at Statesville Penitentiary. These included reorganizing the prison library, revamping the schooling system, and teaching its students in volunteer work in the prison hospital. In 1944, Leopold volunteered for the Statesville Penitentiary Marlia study. It was deliberately inoculated with a malaria study, rather. I'm sorry. He was deliberately inoculated with malaria pathogens and then subjected to several experimental malaria treatments. In the early 1950s, author Meyer Levin, a University of Chicago classmate, requested Leopold's cooperation in writing a novel based on the Franks murder. Leopold responded that he did not wish to have his story told in a fictionalized form, but offered Levin a chance to contribute to his own memoir, which was in progress. Levin, unhappy with that suggestion, went ahead with his book alone despite Leopold's express objections. The novel titled Compulsion was published in 1956. Levin portrayed Leopold under the pseudonym Judge Steiner as a brilliant but deeply disturbed teenager, psychologically driven to kill because of his troubled childhood and an obsession with Loeb. Leopold later wrote that reading Levin's book made him physically sick. More than once, I had to lay the book down and wait for the nausea to subside. I felt as I suppose a man would feel if he were exposed stark naked under a strong spotlight before a large audience. Leopold's autobiography, Life Plus 99 Years, was published in 1958 as part of his campaign to win parole. In beginning his account with the immediate aftermath of the crime, he engaged in widespread criticism for his deliberate refusal, expressly stated in the book, to recount his childhood or to describe any details of the murder itself. He was also accused of writing the book solely as a means of rehabilitating his public image by ignoring the dark side of his past. In 1959, Leopold sought unsuccessfully to block production of the film version of Compulsion on the grounds that Levin's book had invaded his privacy, defamed him, profited from his life story, and intermingled fact and fiction to such an extent that they were indistinguishable. Eventually, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled against him, holding that Leopold, as the confessed perpetrator of the crime of the century, could not reasonably demonstrate that any book had injured his reputation. After 33 years and numerous unsuccessful parole petitions, Leopold was released in March of 1958. In April, he attempted to set up the Leopold Foundation to be funded by royalties from Life Plus 99 Years to aid emotionally disturbed, retarded, quote-unquote, or delinquent youths. The state of Illinois voided his charter, however, on the grounds that it violated the terms of his parole. The Brethren Service Commission, a Church of the Brethren-affiliated program, accepted Leopold as a medical technician at his hospital in Puerto Rico. He expressed his appreciation in an article, "To me, the Brethren Service Commission offered the job, the home, and the sponsorship without which a man cannot be paroled. But it gave me so much more than that, the companionship, the acceptance, the love, which would have rendered a violation of parole almost impossible." He was known as Nate to neighbors and co-workers. At Castor General Hospital in Puerto Rico, where he worked as a laboratory and x-ray assistant. Subsequently, Leopold moved to Santurce and married a widowed florist. He earned a master's degree at the University of Puerto Rico, then taught classes there. Became a researcher in the social service program of Puerto Rico's Department of Health, worked for an urban renewal and housing agency, and did research on leprosy at the University of Puerto Rico's School of Medicine. Leopold was also active in the Natural History Society of Puerto Rico, traveling throughout the island in observance of bird life. In 1963, he published Checklist of Birds of Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. While he spoke of his intention to write a book entitled Reach for a Halo about his life following prison, he never did so. Leopold died of a diabetes-related heart attack on August 29, 1971, at the age of 66. His corneas were donated. It's amazing that he got out of prison at all. I mean, what it means.
Right. I don't think anyone at his age when that crime was committed would get out at this point.
No.
In today's, like the way they sentence today, I don't think he'd have ever gotten out.
No. And it's like, he got out why? I mean, because he wrote a book and because he was behaving. I mean, he was sentenced to life plus 99 years for admittedly murdering a 14-year-old boy. I don't know any other reason why you would say, no, I'm sorry, you don't get parole.
And I just think it's a really odd case. Because honest to God, I really feel like had those people never met, obviously the boy would still have, he would have not been murdered.
Sure.
But I think they would have never individually done anything like that.
Gone down that road. They would have just like stuck
you know what
to
I
like,
mean? Like. Because it's kind of like later in life when he goes to Puerto Rico and doing those things, like maybe that was more of the life he was could have been on.
Yeah.
I mean, they were both so smart. They could have done incredible things, but then they met each other and kind of got obsessed with each other at the same time.
Well, I will say, for being a murderer who was released from prison, he did use the rest of his life really for good. So I guess there can be something positive said about that. But I don't think that that's how, you know, you can look at a majority of cases of releasing child murderers, that they're going to go and help, you know, cure polio or something. I mean, this is just such a bizarre case.
Well, and it's such a sick crime.
Yeah.
You know, because what did you say? They planned it for 9 months?
Yeah.
Or something like that? Like, and by planning it, it's meticulously planned. They very detailed.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, okay, that's the kid. I can't imagine. So at that point, you're just killing because you want to.
Yeah.
It's not even like a crime of passion or anything like that. It was just random.
You know?
Because we have decided we're going to murder someone.
You know what? I have been to their family vacation farm in Charlevoix, Michigan. Yes. The one that was mentioned in there, that the family had like a vacation spot in Charlevoix, Michigan, called The Castle. I am looking it up right now, and I have been there. It's a venue, and if I remember right, like 20 years ago, somewhat of a winery too. And I remember going there one day, and it was called The Castle. And quite honestly, it doesn't look super old. It almost looks like an Olive Garden. I'm not even an Olive Garden with better architecture and more steeples. But it's a neat place. It's a beautiful view. So I can see why someone, you know, super wealthy of the time, you know, that would have been their vacation getaway. But I've been there. So I had no idea of this case or the story of them at all back then.
Look how life comes full circle.
Look at that. About 15, 20 years ago.
It's just so bizarre.
I know.
When you really get into it, like with the Clarence Darrow aspect and like, oh yeah, I mean, you guys are getting off lucky. Your child was just murdered. Mm-hmm. These guys have to go to prison. You know, it was just, the whole thing is just so bizarre.
It would certainly...
No wonder they were wrapped up into this in 1920.
Yeah. Crime of the century. And that...
Which is a pretty big statement when it was only 1920.
I know. It's like, you still got 80 more years. Like, how are we casting this one now? I mean, didn't they call the OJ case the crime of the century or something? What was that? That was used on so many things over the course of that 100 years.
That was a pretty big crime, though.
Yeah, that was. I mean, yeah. And just, it's an amazing story of getting out and doing all those things. I don't think you should have ever gone out, but holy shit, it's just so fucking weird. But
and then like the whole thing with the glasses.
Yeah.
Like, whoops, my glasses fell out just after we dumped the kid's body. And then there happens to be three people.
Well, what baffles me about that is the investigative work that would have had to have been done to determine there were only three people in the city of Chicago that would have had that. I mean, how many places would you had to have literally gone into?
Probably because it's probably just one place sold glasses like
maybe.
That. So they went to that one guy.
And
the guy's like, yeah, here, I have it written down in my ledger.
I mean, today, that's how it would have been done. So maybe it was that easy. But I'm just thinking there's like a gazillion glass places in the city of Chicago. And then try to narrow that down without like just tapping into a database.
Because they were probably what we would call designer frames now.
Okay.
And his family had money. This is just speculation.
Okay.
But his family had money. So he didn't just buy the, you know, I bet most people just had pretty much the same glasses.
Sure.
There's probably it's not like now with they're going to send you five pairs and you try them on and send back, you know,
yeah.
It's not like that.
All different.
It's like, we've got like these three old lady pairs, teenage pairs.
Yeah. I'm just picturing these like detective type, you know, figures, you know, coming into like the bell ringing as they're walking into the dark, you know, glass shop in Chicago late at night. These glasses, do you sell these? You know, like it just, you know, place after place after place.
You saw these glasses, sir. Yeah,
just over and over and over and over. Where today you could just tap into a database, but but maybe it was easier than I'm making it out to be. But what a story, Leopold and Loeb. Thank you for bringing that one to our attention here on the Dark Side, Carol. That was a good one.
You're welcome. It's a good one.
It is.
It's a bad one.
It's a bad one, but a good one to escape an hour of reality.
It's interesting. It's an interesting one.
Certainly is. That's going to wrap up today's episode of The Dark Side of Wikipedia. If you like the show, leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, and we'd greatly appreciate that. Be sure to press the subscribe button wherever you are downloading the show so you don't miss any episodes of the program either. Until next time, for Carol and all of us at Dark Side of Wikipedia, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Boto Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made, because that's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Boto Casino's the social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino. Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.